Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we get to talk with Dr. Warren Newton, Vice Dean and Director of North Carolina AHEC, William B. Acock Distinguished Professor and Chair of the UNC Department of Family Medicine, about AHEC, the past, the present, the future of the transformation that is here and coming in healthcare.
Yeah, this is an incredibly fortunate opportunity that we have, Christy, to talk with a colleague, our boss, and a transformative leader, really about changes that are sweeping medicine that I think every listener should be aware of and is interested in. And first, though, we also have some really interesting research that matters today about things like pain medicine and opioids. Is it really helping?
About extreme binge drinking being common among teenagers.
About what's going to happen with Obamacare and the vast majority of people who do have employer-based insurance. Is it going to impact them at all?
And about diabetes remission after weight loss surgery. So let's get started on pain medicines or these opioid medications and whether or not they're winning the battle against pain.
Yeah, this was really important research that was done out of the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety, where they looked at really claims data for what people were coming to the doctors for opioid use between 2000 and 2010, and tried to determine what changes were occurring. And they found that there was no change in the number of pain-related visits to doctors that resulted in patients receiving treatment with pain relievers.
They also found that during the study period, prescriptions of painkillers that are not these opioid or narcotic medications, those prescriptions remained stable, but the prescriptions for opioids or the narcotic medicines nearly doubled from 11% to 19% over that time period.
And this was published in the journal Medical Care. And what these two pieces of data suggest is that the use of opioids and the prescriptions for them has been escalating fairly dramatically, but it's unclear if this is resulting in significant improvement in patient care. And then the final thing that's really disturbing that Christy and I and many listeners know about is that there is a concern about an over-reliance on these opioids, and the number of people who have been hurt by use of opioids is really fairly dramatic.
And so, I mean, the data suggests that we're not making great headway in relieving pain and suffering, although that's hard to measure, and that we're just continuing to sort of feed into this really epidemic of prescribing and, in some cases, abusing pain medications in our nation.
And I think this is complex, Christy, because I think we have, as providers, we heard a message a decade ago that perhaps we were withholding pain medications from people with legitimate pain, and we were encouraged directly or indirectly to increase our prescribing at the same time that perhaps pharmaceutical companies were marketing products that are very potentially addictive. And so you have this kind of perfect storm out there where we're prescribing them more, we're being encouraged, patients are using them, many of them are getting addicted.
And it's something that's hard to measure. We want to treat someone's pain, but a lot of times the best option is not one of these opioid pain medications.
So like for patients who have zoster or shingles, there's good data that the opioids medication do not work any better than things like ibuprofen and certainly have much higher side effects. So this is a great example where we really have to challenge our conventional wisdom and really rethink, I think, what we took for granted a decade ago, which is to use opioids sparingly and judiciously.
Well, speaking of taking for granted, I think that I perhaps, and now I don't have a teenager, but may have underestimating. I do, but I've got a little time to wait.
Okay.
My kids
okay.
Are 8 and 5. I got a little while. But apparently, extreme binge drinking, and we're talking about, you know, drinking 2 or 3 times typical thresholds of binge drinking, is really common among teenagers in our nation.
Now, this article, which is one of the more disturbing ones for any parent, grandparent, and it was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association subspecialty journal Pediatrics, to really look at 16,000 students between 2005 and 2011. So it's current. And how many of them are binge drinking, which is one out of five on binge drinking five or more drinks in the last 2 weeks.
So, I mean, they defined a drink as a 12-ounce can of beer or a bottle of beer or a glass of wine. And so of this, 20% of the teenagers said they had at least five drinks in the past 2 weeks.
10.5% had consumed at least 10 drinks, and 5% at least 15 drinks. I mean, OMG, Christy.
Seriously, if 10% had consumed 10 drinks in a row, we're talking like in a night, 10, and then 5%, 15 drinks. I mean, that's enough to put down a cow. I mean, it's amazing that an ox. I'm just thinking, like, these are young.
Depending where one lives.
These are young people, presumably, they haven't had that many years of drinking. So to be able to put that much in your body is really scary.
And the number that are presenting into the emergency room with alcohol poisoning is very high. And I think this was actually even higher rates in the South and other parts. So no matter where you are in the United States, please have a conversation with your child, with your loved ones about this research. Ask them about this with their friends. Provide guidance, provide support. This is a serious issue. We want to bring this home to all families across the country.
Well, let's talk about the next study, and this is about Obamacare. So this is very relevant and timely for our listeners. We've got as many as 37 million Americans who get their health coverage through employers. And this was a study done at Stanford and published in Health Affairs, suggesting that that might affect what employees choose for their insurance, but also what employers will do.
So we know that it's happening as we are running this particular show, that the exchanges are out there. People are enrolling. 10 million people may enroll or have coverage. And that's good, because many of these did not have coverage. But for the people who already have employee coverage, many could find that it's cheaper for them to get coverage on the marketplace exchanges than it is to take their employee-sponsored care. Now, that may be good for them, but what it might ultimately do to the entire system, a little bit unknown, but maybe a little scary.
And apparently the study showed that up to 30% of the employers would consider terminating health care coverage for their workers within the first few years of Obamacare, depending on how it plays out. So I think this
because the penalties might be less than the cost of the insurance, which just that really riles me, Christy. If you have an employee that's getting health insurance, I don't care if you think that it's cheaper to pay a penalty. You should continue to provide the health insurance to those employees. I'm going to be out there on that one.
I completely agree. And I think this is something that we're all paying great attention to see how it plays out. But the most important thing is that each person needs to have insurance, and employers need to do the right thing for their employees.
You know who we need to have on the show, Christy? We need to have Dr. Pam Silverman, who's the director of the North Carolina Institute of Medicine and probably one of the national experts on this law and its implications across the board. We should have her on the show soon.
We absolutely should. Let's do our last research that matters, and that is about diabetes remission after weight loss surgery. Adam, we talked about this several months ago and how successful weight loss surgery can be in curing diabetes for some people.
And in this particular study, which was published in the journal The Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology, researchers came up with a scoring system called Diarem, D-I-A-R-E-M, I like the name, based on four readily available patient characteristics like insulin use, age, the hemoglobin A1C, that average blood sugar concentration, and what type of diabetes drugs, to determine whether or not you would achieve complete remission of your diabetes.
And the people who had a low score had the highest chance of remission, and the higher score, you know, the lowest chance of remission. But I think this could be helpful to guide patients in what to expect, and also potentially to help insurance cover these surgeries for
Absolutely.
People.
Absolutely. Well, that'll conclude the Research Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Warren Newton, Vice Dean and Director of North Carolina AHEC and Chairman of the UNC Department of Family Medicine. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we have the pleasure of talking with Dr. Warren Newton, Vice Dean and Director of the North Carolina AHEC and the Distinguished Professor and Chair of the University of North Carolina Department of Family Medicine, about AHEC and the future of medicine.
Dr. Newton, we are thrilled to have you with us from wearing many hats as a leader in healthcare transformation, and most recently in this role as AHEC director. Thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here, Christy.
I wonder if we could start out quickly. We're talking about AHEC because in our world, we know what that means. But my mom and the 25,000 listeners out there across the world might not know exactly what AHEC means and what that means for our state and other states in the nation.
So AHEC actually stands for Area Health Education Center, and the North Carolina AHEC is one of many in the country. It's among the most developed of them, and they all date back to the kind of late 60s, early 70s, as part of a kind of a social movement to improve the health and healthcare education for people in North Carolina.
And before we get too far removed, we should also let our listeners know that we mentioned two hats you play, the chairman of the Department of Family Medicine and now the AHEC director, but you've also been a vice dean of education at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, and you have many hats nationally. And so our topic today is also about the future of medicine. Help us understand, as you go about your daily role in all these different spheres, what are the challenges facing medicine? And then we'll talk about how they affect the work that AHEC does in North Carolina and all states. What are the challenges facing medicine?
I think most people realize the changes that medicine is going through. They see it on the headlines every day. In North Carolina, they see it with respect to Medicaid expansion, the cost of care, scandals about bills and things like that. What I see is really dramatic changes in the face of medicine. So, for example, in North Carolina, if you think about independent hospitals, we've come from 142 to 24 in the last 2 years. And most people think that we'll be between 8 and 12. And independent hospitals in the entire state. It's gone at a speed that is just stunning to those of us who are watching. And there are similar changes with physicians. The North Carolina Medical Society has said that the number of independent cardiology practices in the entire state has gone from 196 to 4 in about 18 months. It's, you know, I, like you, have been observing and participating in healthcare for quite some time. And medicine is always changing, but this isn't usual change. It is transformative change going on right now.
And so thinking about how that affects the people in our state and the people across our nation, you're talking about structural changes as hospitals are buying up practices and practices are having trouble sustaining. And how does that affect patients with respect to cost themselves and quality of care as a mix of this change?
Well, you know, I think we're all aware of Obamacare or healthcare reform. I think the point I make to the professional public, you know, my peers, is that it isn't a matter of waiting until January 1st. It's actually already here. And the kinds of changes I'm talking about are there. As for why, I think most people realize that there are real serious issues with American healthcare. What we have is a paradox. That is, if you are a 500-gram baby, a pound weight, if you are getting have major multiple trauma, if you are getting a transplant organ, a transplant of some sort, there's no place you'd rather be in the world than the United States. On the other hand, if you want to live long, if you want to have a variety of measures of quality of care at the level of population, American healthcare is poorly performing at the level of the population.
By what metrics? By what outcomes? And because I think that that's people know that at some level, but what does that really mean? Because you gave the example of this consolidation of hospitals around the state. Does that have some impacts on people's access to care or the type of care they get?
Yeah, I think you can measure it in a lot of different ways. As a simple measure, how long do we live compared to other people in other countries? Or do we get immunizations, the kinds of things that everybody agrees that you ought to have? So that's at one level. In terms of measured quality of care, in terms of things that we all agree you ought to have. A series of papers and reports in the early part of the last decade suggested that depending on no matter where you were in the continuum of care, from a primary care office to a hospital to a nursing home, what everybody agreed ought to have and happened between 40 and 60% of the time. But I think where we're all seeing the headlines is not so much about quality, although that's there. It's not so much about iatrogenic disease being one of the major causes of mortality. It's about cost. So we do all these things at a price that is roughly at least twice as expensive as other countries.
Well, when you're talking about this population and the experience of our country, I think most lay people really believe that they're getting the best health care in the world here in America, and aren't we so fortunate? There are those graphs from the data you're talking about with we spend some of the most money, and maybe you can say this more accurately than I can, but aren't we tied with Costa Rica or one of the – we're not doing so well.
You know, when I graduated from high school, I would look at those kinds of where does the United States fit compared to everybody else. And we were just below the European countries and Japan in terms of these objective measures. And over my professional lifetime, we've fallen lower and lower. I don't mean to make any comments about Costa Rica per se.
It's a beautiful place. I was there just
this spring.
That's right.
But we're depending on the measure, whether it be a child infant mortality or length of time, we are between 30th and 40th.
Wow.
So we've come a long way.
We're talking with Dr. Warren Newton, a distinguished professor and chair of the UNC Department of Family Medicine and the director of North Carolina AHEC. And Dr. Newton, you've set out here this challenge of transformation in care and quality improvements, and you mentioned cost of care. I know when we come back from our break, we're going to really delve into what are some of the solutions, but help us understand what are some of the challenges in human terms of the cost of care that we're facing in the United States healthcare system.
What my patients talk about is how much they actually pay when they go to the emergency room. They get bills that are just extraordinary, thousands of dollars for a visit. Now, they don't typically pay the entire thing unless they're uninsured, in which case they're dunned, talked about that. So some of it is just the sticker shock of the bills. Some of it is, and that you see that when you go to pharmacies and things like that. So some of it is that, but it's not just cost. It's can you call in the same day and get in to see the doctor that you want to see for whatever you want to take care of, for whatever your problems are.
What I'd like.
That's just plain access. At night, who is taking care of you? If you have medicines coming out of the hospital, do the people who take care of you outside of the hospital know which medicines are you? Are they the same medicines that you were on when you're in the hospital? What we call medication reconciliation. If a test is done, can you get the results back from the test efficiently and effectively? And do you have somebody to talk to about what they mean? That sort of thing is what I'm talking about.
Well, this is very exciting and I think a primer for our listeners to tune in for the second part of this conversation. We do need to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Warren Newton, Vice Dean and Director of North Carolina AHEC, and Chair of the UNC Department of Family Medicine, about AHEC and the future of medicine. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We have been speaking with Dr. Warren Newton, who is Vice Dean and Director of North Carolina AHEC and Chair of the UNC Department of Family Medicine, about AHEC and the future of medicine. Before the break, you were talking about some challenges, but also an exciting vision for what patients could experience in the future of medicine. And I know you've done all of these remarkable leadership elements with your career, and wonder, as we're tying this in with your new role in AHEC, why you chose AHEC as the next step in this piece of healthcare transformation?
You know, I think what starts out for me is my patients and trying to make it better for my patients. And I think most of us know that it's not only what you talk with patients and what you do and what you help patients with, but it's also trying to improve the systems they're working with. And as I see AHEC, we're in the midst of a great transformation in care. It is irrevocable, but we don't yet know what form it's going to take in the end. What form it takes in the end depends greatly on what we're doing in the current time. AHEC in North Carolina is a remarkable institution. It was founded in the early 70s to make a difference in the lives of communities, particularly rural and underserved communities across the state of North Carolina. And it's grown over the years to include not just medicine, but all the professions. So nursing and mental health and pharmacy and so on. And it is in every part of the state, all 100 counties, there is an AHEC presence. And what's impressive to me as I go around to the state is the goodwill that comes with having been there and been at people's side, trying to help them on really difficult problems, like how do you improve access to care in places that have very few people? How do you actually keep a doctor or other healthcare provider in that place? How do you try to get people working in teams? How do you incorporate mental health into a usual primary care or take care of the public system for mental health? The really tough problems AHEC has tried to take on, and that's what's exciting about this. So the question is, all right, why do it now? Why do it in this midst of this dramatic changes? And I think for me, the answer is that AHEC gives a way out of the box. That these the new healthcare system that we are creating will be very different from where we are right now. And what AI can do is help lead that transformation, not only in terms of specific healthcare, but also the kinds of workers and the kinds of healthcare providers we need in order to do the new healthcare.
Help us understand that a little bit, Dr. Newton. If you talk about the training of providers, not just medical students, but all types of providers needed for the healthcare system, North Carolina is a living laboratory. How does AHEC, because the way I understand it is like a spider web. AHEC's at the middle, and you've got all these tentacles out there that are connecting in ways that maybe people wouldn't be aware of. How does it really work, and what's going to change?
Now, mind you, I'm only about a month into this. But what's impressive is that if I go around the state, people come up to me and say, you know, we've got a problem and it has something to do with healthcare, and can AHEC help?
And
we have a problem with mental health and providing mental health. How can AHEC help with this? We have a problem with the oral health across the state. We have huge disparities in rates of cavities and other things. What can AHEC do to help with that? We have ongoing needs for primary care and all the new workers that are going to be necessary in primary care. And they say, well, what can you do to help? Quality and safety. Hospital is putting together a 100,000 lives campaign to try to save lives through implementing, this is the North Carolina Hospital Association, they turn to AHEC to help partner with that as we do.
The other element is that within AHEC systems, it's multidisciplinary. You're training and working with not just doctors, but people and from different angles. And I wonder to what extent those relationships and that training in the community then teaches us back about how we need to change healthcare across the nation.
I think ultimately care will be shifting, not completely away, of course, but we'll have more care that is based in communities with teams of a variety of different professionals. And we don't yet have that model. We're working towards it. And so, yes, I think the kinds of things that we're doing in small communities and in urban communities across the state can have an influence moving forward. I think the big issue is, one of the big issues is as these hospitals begin developing and they develop what we call integrated delivery networks or large hospitals and practices and others, exactly how will they be able to respond to communities and be able to manage the health of populations that they're responsible for? And I think we can help with that, Tim.
So as we move forward in the vision of better quality care, lower cost of care, better outcomes of care, how do you see the quality of care merging more where you have systems of care? So it's not just what happens at, for instance, UNC hospitals, but you have these incredible networks then and electronic medical records. Could you envision AHEC working to help Duke and UNC and Carolina's Medical Center in Charlotte work together collaboratively to help solve some of these really intransigent problems that face all of our healthcare systems, not just a single one?
You know, for some kinds of problems, AHEC is at the table rather than convening, and that's the kind of problem. We've tried hard in the state to develop a health information exchange. We were unsuccessful at that, but we need to get back there because ultimately patients will be well served if there are if information can be transferred from place to place. And I'll give you an example. In other states that have begun to develop this, you can, in Indiana, I just came back from Indiana, that they've developed a statewide network in which they've been able to cut down the risk of resistant bacteria infections by resistant bacteria by 30% over the entire state because they've got a functional health informatics exchange. That's where we need to get to in this state. And we lost that opportunity kind of recently. But that's the sort of thing we need to be at the table for.
And Dr. Newton, I know you've been Dean of Education at the School of Medicine at UNC. And now with these being the director of AHEC with these education centers, that's a big part of who you are. And I wonder what message you are giving to students and future students about what they should be excited about in this healthcare transformation and sort of overcoming fear, but to really lead the future. What are you telling young people?
I'm impressed that young people are actually very idealistic and that you say what we need to do is to really improve the health of the population. Most students are committed to that. So that's the first message, is that's where we need to be. And the second message is don't be afraid. We're going to have to figure this out, and we're going to work together in order to do this. And it's the right thing to do.
Thank you for being with us, Dr. Newton. We've been talking with Dr. Warren Newton, Vice Dean and Director of North Carolina AHEC and Chair of the UNC Department of Family Medicine, about AHEC and the future of medicine. We are going to take a break, but when we come back on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Do you love keeping up with all the latest news and entertainment in Chapel Hill and Carrboro?
Yes!
Well, look no further. The Chapelboro 2.0 app is here. All of your favorite news, sports, columns, seen around town photo galleries, and of course, streaming WCHL 97.9 live.
Your health already with have Dr. Adam Chapelboro Goldstein app? And Dr.
No
Christy
sweat.
Page.
Visit Chapelboro.com
on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have your own questions or even experiences, good or bad, send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. And Christy, we have some really interesting House Call questions about someone who has hearing and vision loss.
About blood in a person's nose mucus.
About someone burning their finger and whether or not that can get infected in the bone.
A listener wondering if a cut of the skin can spread to the bone.
Maybe we'll see if we have time for even a secret question. Erica, what's our very first House Call question from our executive producer, Erica Lloyd?
What does it mean if I have a bit of blood in my nose mucus? I have not had a recent nose trauma, so I'm concerned.
That's a great question, and I think whenever a person has blood from anywhere, it can be scary, so I think it's a good question to ask. It's impressively pretty common to get a little bit of blood mixed in your nose mucus.
Yeah, and even though our listener says they haven't had any recent nose trauma, we do
what
know that a lot of people say they don't pick their nose, but picking of the nose is a type of nose trauma and is a frequent cause of sometimes irritation and even possibly some blood. But we're not going to make any assumptions here. Maybe that's not what's occurred, and so we should talk about other things.
Well, let me just acknowledge that doctors call it, and we're usually talking about children, digital trauma as being nose picking when you stick your finger in your nose. So that could be reason why. Also, the blood vessels are pretty close to the surface in your nose. And sometimes just from inflammation or if you blow your nose hard, you can have a little bit of blood there that doesn't alarm us in any particular way.
Some people have sinus infections. That can cause it. Even some medicines, a common medicine that can cause people to have sometimes nosebleeds is even aspirin. Can do it.
That's right. Well, hopefully you won't have any more of this. But if you did have frequent bloody noses, it would be important to talk to your primary care doctor about that.
Erica, what's our very next House Call?
I recently rode a roller coaster and lost my hearing and vision for about 4 seconds. What could have caused this?
Well, a couple things came to my mind.
I just thought this is scary. And I probably blacked out as I going down that roller coaster. And but not usually. We don't usually black out there where you lost your hearing and your vision.
I mean, 4 seconds is a long time. And sometimes it might seem like a long time. I mean, it could be something simple, like just the anxiety and panic of going on a roller coaster, being upside down, or having sort of a loss of blood flow if you're hanging upside down for a long time, or you just sort of have some jarring that make you sort of kind of freeze up.
But this is a little concerning. I mean, if, you know, I think I would want to see you in the office mm-hmm. and really do a good physical examination. If you're a little bit older or even if you're younger, sometimes you can have trauma from a really rapid movement like that that could hurt the arteries in your neck. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it would hurt both of them at the same time, a little bit unusual, but it certainly can happen for any type of trauma to the neck, a whiplash injury, and that could be really serious and life-threatening. So we would want to see you for that.
You could pass out from a concussion if you banged your head hard as you're going on a jerky roller coaster. So yeah, we'd want to see you and just talk it over, and hopefully it's something that's not too scary.
Yeah, I'd probably avoid that roller coaster for a while, but then it wouldn't take much to get me to avoid most roller coasters.
Let's do our very next House Call from Erica. What do we have?
I burned my finger and the area turned yellow. Could this be infected?
Yes. That was an easy one. No, there's more to that one than just a yes or no.
There is. Sometimes a burn can be a lot more significant than you realize. First of all, I'm always impressed with how badly it hurts. But that skin,
particularly on the fingers.
Yeah, particularly on the fingers. That skin can sometimes make a bubble. It can turn different colors. And it can because you've disrupted your immunity from the world, which is the skin is a very important organ. It certainly can get infected.
The good news is if it's painful, that may be better. I'm not sure if that's good news, but for doctors, that is good news because that means you haven't gone too deep in the burn. Because if you have what's called a third degree burn that goes all the way down, you kind of lose the sensation mm-hmm. in that area that you would not heal and you'd need a skin graft. Versus the other types of burns that are painful probably should still heal up.
if it's on your hand and it's turning colors and you're worried about being infected, I would say definitely get that one checked out. I mean, sometimes you can just sort of have a little burn from a curling iron or something and maybe be okay with some Neosporin. But if it's turning colors on your hand, I think it's worth getting it checked out.
Sounds good. Erica, what's our very next house call?
Can an infection from a laceration spread to the bone?
A laceration being like a cut, if you cut your arm or cut your leg. And the short answer is yes.
You know, Christy, I was just recently attending in the hospital, and we had someone come in that had a boil on their skin, a cut on their skin, and it was right around the knee. And we got really concerned that it was going to go right into the knee and into the knee joint. And so that was a direct extension of where it was located. In other circumstances, you might have a trauma cut on the bottom of your foot, and could it show up maybe in the ankle joint by spreading through the blood? Two different mechanisms. What do you think?
I think, and I've seen this recently too, where people get a wound or an open infection that gets yucky, an infection of the skin, and it can track down typically to the underlying bone, and it can be very hard to treat.
And particularly in people with diabetes, that's
right,
where we really worry, in those ulcers on the bottom of the feet that go into those bones and they get infected bone, and we call that osteomyelitis, a fancy term, and maybe our health sciences librarians can put up
Adam.
A little link up there, because foot exams in our diabetics are one way of preventing those types of ulcers and foot infections from happening. So we would encourage that.
And so if you have a cut that you think is getting infected, getting on early antibiotics and talking with your doctor about, you know, the risk of going to the bone is important.
Erica, we have one last bonus question house call today. What is it?
We should have some music that says bonus question.
The Daily Double.
It's the bonus question.
Is there a way to treat an ingrown toenail at home? All of the people I know that have experienced it have had to undergo a procedure, and I'm really trying to avoid it.
Well, we would encourage you to try to avoid it, because I don't think there's that many doctors who like to do.
I do.
You like to take those toenails off and wedge excisions and bloody and everything.
When it's so full of pus, and what they need is to have it removed.
Never would have predicted that, Chris. You never would have predicted that. Little known things. Well, that's good to know, but it's also good to know that there are some ways you could prevent that. And one of the ways is just by simply pushing the skin that's infected away from the nail, sometimes with getting your foot moist and pushing it away, and gently lifting up the edge of that nail.
Mm-hmm. And over time, if you continue to soak it in warm water and sort of massage that skin around your cuticle away from the nail where it's grown in there, a lot of times you can help it get better. If it's stuck in there and really infected, then a lot of times part of the nail does need to come off.
We will agree that the one thing you should not do is to try to cut down that nail shorter and shorter and shorter to
Bad
try
idea.
To get at the thing, because you got to go to someone like Christy or myself or a family doc or a podiatrist or someone who's experienced, and if they need to lift that nail up with anesthesia because it's painful. Well, thank you so much for that question and all of our house call questions today. We hope we've answered important things to you and your health.
And we want us to share your questions, share your stories. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and our health app by searching the App Store for Your Health, one word.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our great guest today, Dr. Warren Newton. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.